Rishi Sunak is out.
To the country, I would like to say first and foremost, I am sorry.
And Keir Starmer is in.
My government will serve you. Politics can be a force for good.
Who is Britain's new prime minister?
He started off as a human rights lawyer. He was a labor activist in his university and early 20s. In his later legal career, he actually became the chief prosecutor.
Plus, Kyiv reacts to Russian President Vladimir Putin's ceasefire demands. And looking ahead to next week's NATO summit in Washington. Today is Friday, July the 5th. And this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Miller in for Steve Karish. After 14 years in government, Britain's Conservative Party suffered a crushing defeat to Labour in Thursday's election. Outgoing Prime Minister Rishi Sunak spoke to the press outside 10 Downing Street shortly before tendering his resignation to King Charles III.
To the country, I would like to say first and foremost, I am sorry. I have given this job my all, but you have sent a clear signal that the government of the United Kingdom must change, and yours is the only judgment that matters. I have heard your anger, your disappointment, and I take responsibility for this loss.
And shortly thereafter, Keir Starmer, Britain's new prime minister, delivered his first remarks since returning from Buckingham Palace, where he accepted the King's invitation to form a government. Starmer said Thursday's election sent a clear mandate for national renewal and the return of politics to public service.
If you voted Labour yesterday, we will carry the responsibility of your trust as we rebuild our country. But whether you voted Labour or not, in fact, especially if you did not, I say to you directly, my government will serve you. Politics can be a force for good. We will show that. We've changed the Labour Party, returned it to service, and that is how we will govern. Country first, party second.
Joining us from London with more details is Henry Ridgewell. Henry, with Keir Starmer now the new Prime Minister of the UK, can you, share a little bit about who this individual is now that we have yet another Prime Minister leading Britain?
Yes, what is this? The sixth Prime Minister in about 8 years, but a big moment, a change of government after 14 years of Conservative rule. And Keir Starmer, Sir Keir Starmer, as he's known in Britain, is a figure widely known, of course, because of the election campaign and because he's led Labour since the resignation of Jeremy Corbyn. But perhaps his background is less known. He started off as a human rights lawyer. He was a Labour activist in his university and early 20s. In his later legal career, he actually became the chief prosecutor and was responsible for prosecuting high-profile crimes, including terrorism, court cases here in Britain. And then he switched to a political career and rose up the ranks within Labour. He campaigned strongly against Britain's exit from the European Union in 2016 and became the shadow Brexit secretary after that. And then when Jeremy Corbyn resigned following the victory of Boris Johnson in 2019, Keir Starmer took over as Labour leader, and he has sought to steady the ship and to steer Labour back into the centre ground. And that strategy appears to have paid off. He has got a huge majority now and a mandate to push through the policies which he says will reunite and renew Britain.
Speaking to that, we heard his remarks in front of 10 Downing Street earlier today about politics as national service and what he plans to do domestically. turning to the international stage, what kind of inclinations has he given as to what Britain's role will be on a wider stage, so to speak?
This is one of the few elections where the two major parties, Labour and the Conservatives, are united really on the major global flashpoints at the moment. So if you look at Ukraine, Keir Starmer has always supported the Conservatives' policy on supporting Ukraine, on condemning Russian President Vladimir Putin's invasion of that country and giving financial and military support to Ukraine. And Britain has been one of the biggest donors since February 2022, and we fully expect that to continue under Keir Starmer. I suppose the nuances that might be different are that Keir Starmer perhaps has a greater willingness or respect for international institutions, the United Nations or the International Criminal Court, or perhaps even the European Union as vehicles to use Britain's clout in collaboration with allies to try to force international change. But on many of the other major issues, I think the dividing lines between Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak, his predecessor, will be very slim. On Gaza, for example, the Labour Party, he has faced pressure from within that party to be to take a stronger line against Israel in its actions following the Hamas attacks on Israel in October last year. But he has said he is only willing to recognize Palestine as a state as part of a wider peace process. So we don't expect any quick dramatic changes there. Lastly, don't forget that the international landscape is also changing as fast as it is here in Britain. This weekend, the French go to the polls as well. There could be a far-right government come to power there this weekend. Obviously, many eyes are looking across the Atlantic and what happens with the American presidential election later this year. How might Keir Starmer work with a President Trump or even a President Biden? What would that relationship be like? So the international scene, while we don't expect any major foreign policy changes in Britain, I think there's so much change on the horizon that he is going to have to be a nimble player on the international stage as well, starting, of course, with the NATO summit in the next few days in Washington.
Henry Ridgewell reports for us from London. Henry, thanks.
Good to be with you. Thanks, Steve.
In other election news, Iranian presidential candidates Saeed Jalili and Masoud Pezeshkian, surrounded by their supporters, cast votes in the Iranian runoff presidential election. Polls open on Friday for the election that will test the clerical ruler's popularity amid voter apathy. Comes at a time of regional tensions and a standoff with the West over Tehran's nuclear program. The final results of the election will be announced on Saturday, although initial figures could come out sooner. Elsewhere in the Middle East, efforts to secure a ceasefire and hostage release in Gaza was gathering momentum on Friday. This comes after Hamas made a revised proposal on the terms of a deal and Israel said it would resume stalled negotiations. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told U.S. President Joe Biden on Thursday he would send a delegation to resume negotiations, and an Israeli official said his country's team would be led by the head of the Mossad intelligence agency. Turning to Australia, it said on Thursday that it had reached a deal with U.S. technology giant Amazon to build data centers for its military and intelligence information that will boost its military's warfighting capability. Phil Mercer reports the agreement envisions top-secret data stored on a computing cloud in a $1.35 billion partnership.
Three highly secure data centers will be built under the deal in secret locations in Australia and run by an Australian subsidiary of the U.S. technology company Amazon Web Services. The initiative is part of Australia's national defence strategy, outlining its commitment to Indo-Pacific security and maintaining the global rules-based order. The country has a long-standing military alliance with the United States and is a member with the United Kingdom, United States, Canada, and New Zealand of the Five Eyes Intelligence Alliance. Australian officials said the project would create a state-of-the-art collaborative space for intelligence and defence agencies to store and gain access to top-secret information in a centralised network. Andrew Shearer, Director General of Australia's Office of National Intelligence, said in a statement that the project would allow greater interoperability with our most important international intelligence partners. Similar data clouds have been set up in the United States and Britain that allow the sharing of information among agencies and departments. Richard Marles, Australia's Deputy Prime Minister and Defence Minister, told reporters that highly sensitive national security data will be safely secured in the new system.
If you consider any sensor which is on a defence platform, which in turn feeds that data to a high-tech capability such as the Joint Strike Fighter, which will use that to engage in targeting or perhaps to defend itself from an incoming threat or indeed to defend another asset such as a ship, all of that is top secret data.
The government said the Amazon Web Services storage system will use artificial intelligence to detect suspected intrusions and to retrieve data. Richard Buckland is a professor in cybercrime, cyber war, and cyber terror at the School of Computer Science and Engineering at the University of New South Wales. He told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that the storage plan has its risks.
Putting more data together in a central spot and sharing it widely, as people intend to do, obviously increases the risk of a data breach.
In a statement, Amazon Web Services Managing Director in Australia, Ian Rouse, said the system would enable the seamless sharing of classified data between Australia's national intelligence community and the Australian Defence Force. The so-called top secret cloud is scheduled to be in operation by 2027. Phil Mercer, VOA News, Sydney.
Still to come, Kenya's president makes some concessions.
The consequence of withdrawing the finance bill is the reduction of our revenue targets by $346 billion.
This is VOA News. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. On Thursday, Russian President Vladimir Putin said that Russia wouldn't declare a ceasefire in Ukraine until Kyiv takes what he called positive steps. Putin added that if Russia were to agree to a ceasefire, it would allow Moscow's enemy to improve its position, rearm, and bolster its defenses. That same argument has been made by Ukraine and others as to why Kyiv should also not enter into a ceasefire agreement. Joining us now from the Ukrainian capital with more reaction and updates is Anna Chernikova.
It's not particularly an official reaction on that, on this latest statements by Putin, but basically Ukrainian authorities, it looks like at least, do not really try to comment every statement because President Putin, he is very consistent with what he's saying, and he's just repeating the rhetorics and repeating the main points he wants to deliver to the international community, to the Ukrainian community, and basically he already said similar things before, maybe in different words, and previously Ukrainian authorities already made a number of statements that basically Russian Federation do not want to stop until they really feel they cannot just continue this war anymore.
Anna, earlier this week, Hungarian President Viktor Orban met with Zelensky there in Kyiv, and Russian media is now reporting that he's in Moscow. Has there been any reaction from authorities there on this visit?
No official reaction yet from the Ukrainian authorities. However, it might be by the end of the day. Usually President Zelensky comment on different kind of international events happening in his evening address to the nation. At this point, there is no reaction. However, there are, of course, talks about it. And here in Ukraine, there is, again, understanding that Mr. Orban, he is quite a pro-Russian person and pro Putin person, and everyone here knows his good relations with Putin. At least this is how it looks on the public stage. And it's not really a big surprise that he went to Moscow after Kyiv. However, of course, we're hearing from Josep Borrell and from other European officials that basically Orbán do not have an authority to talk on behalf of EU in Moscow. So it was not something that he agreed on with the EU officials and EU leadership when he went to Moscow. But there is understanding that Orbán is trying to demonstrate that he will be considering Russian position and Putin's position, Putin's proposals to persuade inside of European community and for Ukraine in order to reach any kind of peace agreement.
And one last question. There are some reports that Ukrainian forces had to fall back from some areas on the outskirts of Chasiv Yar on Thursday. What can you tell us about the latest situation on the front line?
Yes, so we're hearing that situation at the eastern front line remain extremely difficult, and in some areas is critical for Ukrainian forces. Ukrainian forces had to withdraw from a very important area in the Chasiv Yar location at the front line. At this point, Chasiv Yar is still not fully under Russian control. However, this is quite a strategic place, and it looks like the Russian forces are taking it over, and advancing is continuing. President Zelensky, in his latest address to the nation, said that he again had another long and fruitful meeting with all the military leadership from different sectors, from different directions, and he announced that Ukraine will continue to increase the defense lines, the defense positions along the front line in the east and the south, and in the northern parts as well, which are closer to the border with Russia. And he particularly said that electronic warfare, drones, and air defense, these are three main concerns. And this is three main areas and directions that Ukrainian officials will be talking to with allies and will be spending financing on, because this is basically what Ukrainian forces are lacking, and this is what could help to defend those territories and the whole territory of Ukraine, and also to stop Russian forces from at least advancing. We're not talking now about Ukrainian forces taking back the territories, because at this point the main goal is to defend the positions, defend the territories which are under the most big pressure.
Anna Chernikova reports for us from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna? Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
So what challenges face the NATO alliance as members gather in Washington next week? To get some perspective, VOA's Russian service sat down with retired General Philip Breedlove. He's a former commander of the U.S. European Command.
There are lots of things that NATO will be considering, but I think, as you have termed it, the main challenge is going to be how to move forward with Ukraine. There are quite a number of NATO nations that want to get started on Ukraine's program to join. There are other nations that are not ready for that yet. And so I think that the compromise, as you have heard, is this bridge to NATO, whereby Ukraine will be given or invited to join in a headquarters on a U.S. base somewhere. I hear that maybe Wiesbaden is that place, whereby we will more formally engage Ukraine on how to support Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera. And so this is seen as that bridge to bring them aboard. More importantly, though, since there will not be a formal offer to Ukraine for membership, the members of NATO are going to need to discuss how do we begin to guarantee the security of Ukraine. And that is a conversation that's going to be very, very important and frankly very tough, since it falls in the shadow of the failed Budapest Memorandum of 1994.
So elections in Europe and in the UK, how do you think will they affect and maybe already affected the immediate future of NATO?
So I would broaden that scope up. I mean, elections in America, elections in many of our countries, we see a growing nationalistic trend, some isolationist trends. And these are all going to have to be addressed by NATO as a body, because the strength, as we know, of NATO is solidarity first. And so we have to figure out how to maintain that solidarity in the alliance when we have, several nations that are challenging norms, is maybe the way to say it. And you know that NATO has always made it through this. I remind people, and some of my French friends hate it when I do, but we were once thrown out of a capital of a NATO country. And so NATO has faced challenges in the past. And I think that this current set of issues, NATO will survive them as well, and frankly, maybe be stronger. The absolute audacity, the criminality, the inhumane war that Mr. Putin is waging on Ukraine is in a way drawing NATO closer together. Even though there are less than perfect conversations about how we should go about fixing things, the fact of the matter is that broadly now, people understand what Mr. Putin is, what Russia represents, and the problems that this is going to give us in the future. And we see, again, the benefit of nations now realizing that they have to invest in their defense.
That was the former commander of the U.S. European Command, as well as the 17th Supreme Allied Commander Europe of NATO Allied Command Operations. His name? Retired General Philip Breedlove. He was speaking to my colleagues in the VOA Russian service. And finally, we turn to Africa, where Kenyan President William Ruto announced sweeping spending cuts after withdrawing a controversial tax hike that sparked nationwide protests.
The consequence of withdrawing the finance bill is the reduction of our revenue targets by $346 billion.
Ruto is speaking about Kenyan shillings, which is about $2.7 billion U.S. dollars. The president also outlined to the public the cuts to be made.
47 state corporations with overlapping and duplicating functions will be dissolved, resulting in the elimination of their operational and maintenance costs, and their functions will be integrated into the respective line ministries. The number of advisors in government shall be reduced by 50% within the public service with immediate effect. Budget lines providing for the operations of the Office of the First Lady, the spouse of the Deputy President, and the Prime Cabinet Secretary will be removed.
Public servants who turn 60 will be required to immediately retire with no extensions, and he announced suspending the purchase of new government vehicles for 12 months, except for security agency, as well as halting non-essential travel by state officials. Analysts say that the bill's withdrawal is likely to result in Kenya missing targets in its IMF program, although the government does not have any debts coming due for which it urgently needs cash. At least 39 people were killed in clashes with police last week, and some demonstrators briefly stormed the parliament. And with that, it concludes today's program. There's more, of course, 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and on our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone at VOA, we thank you for listening. And until next week, I'm Steve Miller. For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.